Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, it's one of the lesser-known moments of St. Augustine's notorious civil rights swim-in. We explore the story of 16 rabbis arrested in solidarity with Black protesters 60 years ago this month. Later, we explore the city's return on investment for art spending and cultural capital. But first, on July 2, 1964, President Lyndon Johnson signed into law the Civil Rights Act, prohibiting discrimination and ordering the integration of schools and public places. All this month, we're going to commemorate the 60th anniversary of that landmark law, including today when we remember the largest mass arrest of rabbis in the history of the United States. To discuss that, we're joined by Rabbi Merrill Shapiro, president of the St. Augustine Jewish Historical Society. Welcome, Rabbi.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having us and for helping us tell this important story.
100%. Marcia Grado, also here, St. Augustine Jewish Historical Society officer. Welcome, Marcia.
Welcome, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And Melissa Williams, Holocaust educator at the LJD, Jewish Family and Community Services here in Jacksonville. Hi, Melissa. Welcome back.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Rabbi Shapiro, I want to start with the remarkable story of how this protest came to be. It began on June 11th when a group of rabbis received a letter from Martin Luther King while he was in jail in St. Augustine. Tell us what happened at that point.
It was actually a telegram. In fact, it was cute the way Rabbi Cy Israel Dresner, who was billed as the country's most frequently arrested rabbi, always arrested for one civil rights event or another, received a telegram from Martin Luther King. It actually went to his home synagogue in Springfield, New Jersey. The rabbis of the Reform Movement, the Central Conference of American Rabbis, were meeting at a convention in Atlantic City. And so they forwarded it to him. Rabbi Dresner points out how the strips were, how a Western Union telegram worked in the old days, which we were, those of us of age, were well familiar. It asked them to get as many, it asked him to bring as many rabbis as possible down to St. Augustine. They were eager, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Martin Luther King and the people around him were eager to keep the civil rights movement in the headlines, in part because of exactly what you spoke of. There was a filibuster in the U.S. Senate against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and they wanted to create a situation where there would be pressure, and they were actually turned out to be very successful.
And so that telegram went to his home synagogue, but he brought it to this convention, and what did he do there?
Yeah, okay, so there he received it, and it reached him in Atlantic City, and he was going to give it to the president of the Central Conference of American Rabbis. There were 500 rabbis or so there. And he said the president wasn't so hot on the issue of civil rights, so he gave it to the vice president. The vice president immediately went to the podium and read the telegram. And immediately these 15 of them, 15 rabbis and one administrator of for the Social Action Committee of the Reform Movement of Judaism, immediately got up, went to their hotels, and started to pack their bags. Some of them leaving behind wives. Rabbi Vogel, his wife, who was here in 2014, complained he left me with two kids in diapers in a hotel room in a strange city. But as they were heading for the hotel, down the elevator comes Rabbi and Doctor and Professor Eugene Borowitz, and they said, "Gene, turn around. We're all going to St. Augustine." And he agreed.
So 16 rabbis and this one administrator, and they left directly from the conference.
They left directly from the conference without stop being at home and so on. They came from various places around the country and all got on a plane and came to Jacksonville.
And Marcia Grado, they came to St. Augustine in June 1964, and they were heading into a very dangerous place.
Yes, and I just want to make mention, you mentioned about a protest. It was not a protest, actually, as we know the word protest. It was actually more of a demonstration or a gathering in support of a cause. And, I mean, it was... You know, I'm from New York, and we didn't have these things going on up there in this kind of magnitude. So it was very hard to conceive of the intensity of what actually took place.
So
but to have 16 rabbis arrested by the city police at one time was unconscionable.
The city police was very different than Melissa. Martin Luther King would later call St. Augustine one of the most violent places he had ever visited. He called it the most lawless city he'd ever seen. And he'd, you know, been to some places. Reverend Andrew Young at the time was with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, but later, of course, a UN ambassador and a congressman. And he said, St. Augustine is really worse than Birmingham. It's the worst I've ever seen. So it was a really hostile place at that time.
It's very shocking. And I know that the rabbis that were there during their time, even as older men, looking back on the time they spent there, said that it was the most terrifying experience they've ever had.
There was a sort of deputized Klansman, I guess, for lack of a better word. His name was Hoss Manusi. But he was empowered by the sheriff at the time, L.O. Davis, to help control, I'm using air quotes, these protests that were occurring nightly in St. Augustine and daily, you know, in these integration attempts. But
By the way, it was interesting that we of the St. Augustine Jewish Historical Society were able to bring back six of the rabbis on the 50th anniversary in 2014, and they all wanted to know what became of Hoss Manusi and his family and so on and so forth. They were very curious.
What was the answer?
And the answer was we could not locate anybody. We really hadn't tried. It wasn't in our wheelhouse at that time, and it remains for us to... There are Manusis, of course. They're plentiful in the area, and that's an avenue for exploration.
So 7 days after receiving this telegram, June 18th, is this, as you say, a demonstration, yeah. Marcia. It was envisioned as a swim-in protest at the Monson Motor Lodge, which was the focus of a lot of these demonstrations.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What purpose did the rabbis serve?
Okay. So they serve a purpose, of course, of representing Jewish interest in this matter, as they point out very poignantly in their letter that they wrote that night, in the next morning, actually. They read it at 3 a.m. on June the 19th. They started St. Paul, what today is St. Paul, it was then as well, St. Paul AME Church. They walked north to what was then the Monson Hotel. It's on the site now of the historic Bayfront Hilton on Avenida Menendez, and it was well orchestrated and arranged that they would walk arm in arm with a young black teenager from each of them from Albany, Georgia, and they walked into the doorway of the Monson lunchroom and there began to pray. They, of course, were bringing blacks into an area where blacks were not permitted, and so they were arrested for disturbing the peace.
And so this hotel site became really notorious because of images that were taken of the owner of the hotel as black and white protesters jumped in the pool to have an integrated swim in. And he poured muriatic acid into the pool while they were in there, saying he was cleaning the pool. But the rabbi's presence, Marcia, allowed that to happen.
It was probably, it's almost like blaming the rabbi's presence for that incident.
Well, weren't
occurring.
They intended as kind of a decoy? I mean, I think that wasn't that.
They certainly didn't want that to happen.
Yeah,
that was a spontaneous thing owner of the hotel.
I don't mean that. I mean enabling the protesters to get into the pool.
Yeah, it turns out the Southern Christian Leadership Conference really had this well orchestrated and did a lot of planning. And even though the people involved in the parts were not all aware of what was happening, the rabbis, in fact, distracted everyone so that they were all turning to the entrance of the lunchroom of the Monson. And at that time, Mimi Jones and several black teenagers jumped into the swimming pool. Immediately after them, and there's a famous photo of a deputy fully clothed with his gun and everything jumping into the pool to get them out. And shortly thereafter, the owner manager of the hotel goes to get muriatic acid and pour it in. That picture is taken by an Associated Press photographer, hits the newspapers in the large northern cities, and helps to break the filibuster that's taking place in the Senate to allow for passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Bill.
Which did then happen the next day.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, we're remembering the 60th anniversary of the mass protest and arrest of 16 rabbis in St. Augustine. You can join the conversation live on air by calling us at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjcd.org, or you can reach out on social media. Melissa, your organization hosted, and it continues to host, a free exhibit that commemorates this event, and it's named after the letter that the rabbis wrote that night that they were arrested.
Yes, it's called We Could Not Be Silent. We have at our agency a permanent Holocaust memorial gallery that was created by Morris Bendit, who is a local Holocaust survivor. Surrounding that memorial, we have a yearly rotating exhibit. So this year, because of the 60th anniversary, we decided that it would be a great time to highlight this history that happened right down the road from us.
And this letter that they wrote, it is a really moving manifesto, Why We Went, is what it's called. Excuse me. And you can't read it all, but they wrote that St. Augustine will long be remembered as a symbol of harsh, rigidly segregated, Klan-dominated, backward-looking city, which mocked the spirit of the African-born priest for whom it was named. They also said, here in St. Augustine, we've seen the depths of anger, resentment, and fury. We've seen the faces that expressed a deep, implacable hatred. And what disturbs us more deeply is the large number of decent citizens who have stood aside, unable to bring themselves to act. So that's part of the central theme of their letter, Rabbi Shapiro. Yeah.
Right.
It has to do with the Holocaust.
It has to do with the Holocaust and the role of bystanders. They talked about in their letter those who were aware of in Germany during the Holocaust of what was going on. They could see the smoke rising from the crematoria, and they did nothing. A historian, philosopher of the Holocaust in the late 50s, early 60s, named Raoul Hilberg, wrote a book called about the Holocaust called Perpetrators, Victims, and Bystanders. And he was the first to put the spotlight on the bystanders, those who do nothing in the face of evil. And they, of course, exist even to this very day. When there's injustice, there are people who are active and involved. There are victims and there are perpetrators, but there are bystanders who stand by and do nothing. And the rabbis railed against that and were very upset. They did not want to be part of the bystanders. They could not do nothing. They had to be active on behalf of the pursuit of justice.
They also said, we couldn't pass the opportunity to achieve a moral goal by a moral means, they said, a rare modern privilege, which has been the glory of the nonviolent struggle for civil rights. But nonviolent wasn't quite the story. This was a time of great violence, Marcia, and, they were greeted with, as I said, a lot of pushback, people carrying cattle prods, people throwing bricks. So this was a very difficult thing to stand up for and have courage to do that.
Well, there's always been, through the ages, persecution where it comes, where Jewish people are involved. And we just have to be strong and stand for what we believe is correct and right and just. Mm-hmm. And take into consideration the fact that everybody has feelings and everybody has a right to their own space.
The dates are important on this, Melissa. I just kind of want to review them. So June 18th, the rabbis arrive. They're arrested. June 19th, the Senate filibuster ends after 60 days, holding back the Civil Rights Act. And then 2 days later, three men, freedom riders, went missing in Mississippi, became the subject of the film Mississippi Burning. But two Jewish young men, Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, and then a man from Mississippi named James Cheney, were ended up murdered by the Klan. So this was right in a time when standing up for things that you believed in was not only, dangerous, but lethal, potentially.
Correct. Yeah, it was a horrible story that happened, and people put their lives on the line. But when we bring people through our exhibit, one thing that we like to end with is the feeling of hope. Like, you don't have to be the person putting your life on the line, but there's a lot that you can do behind the scenes to make things happen, to make good changes in the world.
We have a question from James. He emailed, there are various denominations in Judaism. Were these rabbis from a specific denomination?
Yes, they were. That's an interesting question. They were from the Reform movement, the least anchored in tradition. Orthodox is the most anchored in tradition, and conservative is in the middle. We spoke 10 years ago with the rabbis why they thought that was, and Rabbi Dresner in particular noted that the Reform movement, which had a tradition dating back to 1885 of not believing there would ever be a Jewish state in the Middle East or a Jewish state anywhere, didn't worry about the rise of the modern state of Israel. Instead, they concentrated on civil rights, while the rabbis of the other denominations were interested at that time in the development of the state of Israel. And so their focus was taken in a different direction. That's an excellent question.
Oh, I want to ask you, 1964 was known as Freedom Summer, and that was in part because of what these freedom riders were doing to try to, you know, enable civil rights and protesters to do so peaceably. But more recently in the state of Florida, you might know that that name has been somewhat adopted by the current administration to govern things like tax breaks and lighting our bridges in red, white, and blue. That's been labeled Freedom Summer. Is that at all concerning, controversial in the community of people that are trying to remember this history?
There's certainly the cheapening of language has certainly been on our radar screen for decades. At one time, the word magnificent, for example, referred to Niagara Falls or the Grand Canyon or a beautiful sunset, the Aurora Borealis, and so on. Now you could, and then we came to an era when you can open the paper and a certain store would say, we're having a magnificent lingerie sale. Mm. Oh, yeah. And it really is unfortunate. So we're concerned about the cheapening of language and the approbation of language. And by the way, this is right out of Orwell's 1984 and Animal Farm. Tweaking the language to have it mean what suits you rather than the real fundamental meaning.
Marshall, what are the modern lessons that you think we can take from the demonstrations that occurred 60 years ago today in St. Augustine?
Well, the first thing is that we have to keep it in people's minds. We can't let people forget that these events were significant and that they meant a great deal to a very large number of people, and that they did promote change. And commemorating this event every year on the date, on June 18th, at the site, which we actually have a plaque set up on the spot where that took place, is very important for everyone in the area, especially, to acknowledge that these events took place. They were real. They weren't fake history. And that it needs to be commemorated and remembered so that people can move on in a positive direction.
Yeah, we see it as a booster shot to people to say, let's remember it not to be bystanders. By the way, the book of Deuteronomy says in Hebrew, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, justice, justice shall you pursue. There are actually 613 commandments in the five books of Moses, all of them done at the appropriate time, except for that one commandment. You don't wait for injustice. You have to pursue injustice. You have to look for injustice. You have to be active, not a bystander, and find that injustice and do all that is within our power to set it right and to bring about a community of justice.
So how can people participate in this coming up event, Marsha?
We would like them to show up.
Mm.
We would
like
them to be there. It will be on Tuesday, next 2 weeks from today, June 18th, at the Hilton
The
Bayfront Inn on Menendez Avenue. It's an outdoor thing, and the gathering will be in the courtyard of that hotel. And the letter, in its entirety will actually be read by Nancy Sykes Klein, who is the mayor of St. Augustine. She has graciously agreed to read it again this year, as she did last year.
And what time does that start?
And it starts at noon.
All right. And Melissa, if people want to know more about the exhibit that you have up at the Frisch Gallery.
Yes, they can visit resisthate.com. It's resisthatejax.com. Okay. And we're open Monday through Friday. In the summertime, on Fridays, we close at 1 o'clock, but all the other days, we're open from 8:30 to 5.
But that's free to the public?
Free to the public, yes.
Well, Meryl Shapiro, Marcia Grado, Melissa Williams, thank you all so much for being here and talking about this important history.
And thank you for helping us call attention to this important event.
Up next, a return on investment in the arts. Welcome back. The city's proposed investments in a new stadium and a new jail have made headlines in the last several weeks, but what about civic investment in the arts? To take a closer look at cultural capital, I'm joined by Diana Donovan, Executive Director of the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Hey, Diana.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for being here. And Jason Peoples, Executive Director of the Jacksonville Arts and Music School, JAMS. Welcome back.
You're right. Good morning.
It's only been a short while since I've seen you last. So
exactly.
I'm glad to have you back. So, Diana, billions of dollars are being tossed around here. A billion there for a stadium, a billion there for the jail. Where does the arts stand in all of this spending and all of this discussion?
Yes. So one of the most interesting things about the Cultural Council is that we have the honor of being able to be a financial steward and a agent of the city for nonprofits. And so as a regranting agency, 92% of all the funding that we get goes back out to the community, which if you look at a traditional nonprofit, the traditional number is between 75 to 85%. So we maintain a huge identity of giving to get. And the when we think about the cultural economy, we think about igniting the cultural economy. Right now, the city of Jacksonville funds $8.25 million in operating and capital grants for what we call cultural service grantees. These are nonprofits in the community, changing the landscape, quality of life. And oftentimes we think of them as maybe a traditional visual artist or maybe a school, like we think about JAMS. But oftentimes we forget the fact that these are small businesses as well, and that they're also igniting the creative economy. So when we look at last year's numbers, prior to the $8.25 million, we were at $5.25 million approximately. That economic impact is at $114 million.
Wait, I'm going to stop you for a second because I'm, first of all, losing track of the numbers. That five point and the eight point, what do those reflect?
So that reflects the investment of the city giving us funding to be able to regrant in real time.
Okay.
And so take that funding and give it out to the nonprofits.
I got you. So to start though with this, the Civic Council is, you say it's an agent of the city government. Mm-hmm. Is it appointed members? Is it a board that the city council appoints, that the mayor appoints?
Yeah. So the Cultural Council Greater Jacksonville is a nonprofit. So we're an independent nonprofit. We have six mayoral appointees and the rest are community appointed on our board. And we seek to serve to enhance the mission and vision of quality of life, of arts and culture being seen as essential. And one of our core identities over the past multiple decades has been a regranting agency on behalf of the city as well as privately. So private funders would include like a Florida Blue or a PNC, where we would do micro grants out to the artist and to the communities and the nonprofits. And then on the flip side, you know, advocacy with the city to help make sure that, you know, these nonprofits, like during COVID, we almost lost some of our largest perpetuators of economic investment. And when we think about downtown and we think about it being the heart of the city of Jacksonville and people wanting to perpetuate and invest and activate and the Jaguars and their role that they play, we often forget about the fact that we have multiple museums like a Mosh and a Mocha and a Florida Theater. They're open one night and the restaurants are activated, the bartenders are activated, the bartenders are paid, Ubers, you know, people driving down, driving around, parking lots, paid parking. We don't think about often the economic heavyweights that they are and the drivers. And when we look at, you know, they self-report their numbers, these nonprofits we give funding to, and they come back to us with their economic investment. And so when the city gives us like, you know, $5.25 million, when we are able to track back those numbers, it goes back to that $114 million number, with the majority over 100 being from downtown. So we have a lot of money going inside and outside of downtown because of these cultural sector nonprofits.
And so, Jason, your organization is a recipient of Cultural Council funding?
Correct.
So is that something that you have to apply for annually, or is it something that is kind of granted to you over a period of time?
It is something that we apply for annually with the CSG loans and then or grants, rather. And also the capital grants that have come online in the past 2 years, I believe it's been, mm-hmm. Diana. Which has been amazing in terms of being able to help us grow as a facility and an organization that is serving youth, which is extremely important because with our mission to empower the creative leaders of tomorrow, we want to do what me and Diana talk about all the time, is to create these right left brain thinkers. Mm-hmm. Like usually when we're going to talk to politicians, we're talking to them about numbers. And then when we go to artists, we have to talk to them about art, you know, and how do you bridge that gap between the two? Well, you create these young teenage minds that are going off to college to think both creatively and logically as well, so that they can be the leaders that we need tomorrow and be able to put more funding in into the hands of organizations like the CSG and Cultural Council.
And your organization, you were on recently, but remind us about the kids that you serve and what it is that you teach them.
Yeah, so the kids that we serve a population from 4th to 12th grade. Now that is extending through college because we have a lot more students going to college. Again, that mission to empower the creative leaders of tomorrow was meant to address diversity in our city and leadership in our city. There's a lot of emphasis through things like Leadership Jacksonville, Hightower Fellowship, even we were just talking about Leadership Florida,
yes.
That place emphasis on leadership at the adult level. And what we wanted to do was find a way to address the students. And we wanted to do that creatively. So we thought that art could be used as a conduit to create innovative thinking and leadership. And that's what we've done. The biggest thing is, you know, the science community says that you don't often find what you don't often find. Right. And what we haven't found in Jacksonville in the past few years is organizations like the Cultural Council that have been successful at galvanizing politicians, public and private sectors, artists for the purposes of this conversation, and putting them under one banner, which is to move forward with economic growth and development through culture. Right. We have that conversation all the time about, you know, well, what do I do while I'm waiting on the concert? You know, well, I'm walking around downtown looking at murals. What happens if the murals aren't there? What happens if the Cultural Council can't give the money to the artist so that the mural is there? So those things are being addressed. And we just want to make sure that as an organization that we're backfilling and creating sustainable leadership as Diana and I grow older, which we're not old right now, but as we grow older, that we're creating sustainable leadership for the future.
We're talking about art spending in the city of Jacksonville. You can join our conversation by calling 904-549-2937, or you can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We have an email from Jim. He says, we often hear about the return on investment for the city's other spending, stadium, Jacksport, dredging, et cetera. What is the ROI for the city's spending on culture?
Ah, that's that $114 million number. The specific number is $114,714,454.
How's that calculated?
So what we'll do is like their program expenses times two, and it's based off of the UNF's entrepreneurial programs formula that they give to us to establish economic impact. I can give a few other numbers for Jim as well. We had 5,973 events and performances through these 30 nonprofits last year. Close to 4,000 local artists participated directly through the programming, exhibitions, and educational programs. About 1,500 jobs in the arts and culture sector, so keeping our jobs local in the Northeast region. 3,546 vendors and small businesses engaged to support events and programming and operations. 130,000 volunteer hours donated.
Let me ask you about the spending, I mean, on arts grants. And I know that there's something that is called Arts in Public Places. That's
a
program that basically earmarks a certain amount, a percentage of money that's spent on construction that the city does.
Yes.
And that goes towards arts.
0.75%. And that funding goes into city managed for the Art in Public Places program.
That's not managed by you all?
So the city of Jacksonville, we manage the actual facilitation of the program, but the city owns the management of the actual funding. But we will work with an appointed committee, an Art in Public Places program committee, and they come together and they look at opportunities to activate public art throughout the city of Jacksonville, Duval County, Greater Jacksonville. And then through that committee, we'll pick art selection panels specific to communities that'll be appointed by the community. And then they'll help select the artist, the call to artists, what they want it to look like. It's a way to help bring identity and preference to the cultural temperament of the area we're serving specific to that side of Jacksonville. So if we're, you know, in the north side, if we're downtown, if we're in San Marco, all of those places have different personalities and different preferences of what art they would want to represent them. So we have art selection panels that serve to select it, the committee that helps to make sure the process is decided on, and then we help facilitate the process. And then going back to economic impact, we also work really hard to make sure that we have an elevation of local artists being served and selected and grown through that process, as well as, you know, when we think about fabricators, installers, and that capital improvement projects. Public art is essentially capital improvement projects, especially when you're doing a large sculpture work. So it's nice to be able to partner with them and keep that money local in the Northeast region as well.
Is it a zero-sum game, though, when it comes to city spending? If we're talking about, as we've mentioned, all of these massive expenditures that the city is, you know, trying to button up and line up for the mm-hmm. coming years, does that cut into, I mean, there really only is a limited amount of money, right? And when it comes to spending, does the arts take a hit?
I think historically, when I first started in this role during the pandemic, we were at the same funding as we were at 20 years ago. And that was hard because you had approximately only $2.25 million for over 30-plus nonprofits taking very slim pieces of the pizza. One of the things that we've been intentionally been able to do is, through both mayoral administrations, continue to build trust and stewardship and funding to keep increasing that number for operational grants, which pay for the least sexy things like administrative salaries, program expenses, and then also, to the point that Jason made, capital. Capital infrastructure deferred maintenance is a huge challenge. For example, a small theater that may have to choose between paying a person or paying for AC. And I know that, you know, we get hot in July and nobody wants to sit in a theater without AC in July. So then all of a sudden their revenues, you know, hit or plummeted, actually. And so for us, we started with the city 3 years ago to do $250,000 capital grant program match one for one. That's public and private investment. Then we grew it to 500,000, match one for one. Then we grew it to 1 million, match one for one. One of the things the Cultural Council as a nonprofit believes in is the beautiful marriage of public and private sector investment. It has to happen together. It can't be all on the taxpayers, on the city. It can't be all on the private. It has to be a beautiful, like, matrimony of mutual investment where the nonprofits are able to steward that funding for high quality program experiences and quality of life. So people want to eat, stay, and play here.
And so, Jason, for people who are looking at this from, you know, a priority standpoint in the city of Jacksonville, how do you persuade people, you know, that this kind of spending should be at the top of their list as opposed to all of these other pulls that they have on needs economically that the city faces?
Mm. So I have this conversation all the time with individuals, and I say that artists push the boundaries of possibility so that those of us that are conservative can live comfortably within them. And it's important for us to continue to push those boundaries if we want our city to grow and expand, because then if you're the conservative, then you start to, you know, feel the weight of individuals being, you know, close in close proximity or whatnot. You know, it starts to get overpopulated, you know, all these things. So those artists are thinking constantly about how to move the needle of our city, to grow our city, to make it more efficient, to put those arts and entertainment and culture there that people want to be a part of. So it's extremely important in terms of us as an organization serving over 150 students in the building, and then over 3,000 students, families, in the community throughout the year. There is a huge, huge need for us to continue to do what we do mm-hmm. as artists and what we do as an organization, simply because it's what's going to guarantee that those students that leave actually want to come back.
Yeah.
And right.
Keep Jacksonville.
Right. It makes no sense to build all the fancy buildings and the roadways and everything else if all your talent is leaving and no one is here to sustain it in the future. What do we have?
Well, Diana Donovan, Jason Peoples, thank you so much for coming on today and talking about art spending and where it fits into the whole overall economy.
Thank you. And we have, you know, America for the Arts. We just did an economic impact study with them. And I just want to share real quick that we had $319.9 million in economic activity in the greater Jacksonville area, with 2.1 non-local and local residents coming in to visit. So we got big things on the horizon.
Thanks, Diana.
Awesome.
All right. Up next, unleashing creativity through handmade print media. And we're back. Fans of zines, alt weeklies, and DIY comics know that much of the fun is figuring out how to do it on your own. This month, the Jacksonville Public Library celebrates that independent legacy when it hosts the third annual Duval Comic and Zine Festival. And to talk about it, I'm joined now by DCAS, I guess we say, DCAS organizers Lindsay Anderson and Dan Whaley. Welcome to both of you.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Yes, hi, good morning.
So, Dan, a lot of people think about comics and they expect them to be like funny. But they often take on very serious subjects, as do yours.
Yeah, so I make mental health comics, disseminating information without all the psychobabble. So anywhere from like 25 to 40 pages on emotional manipulation and parental family roles. But some of them are funny, but they are very serious in nature. And I ask the reader a lot of questions so they can process some of the things that they've gone through and learn about that as well. And we also have the speaker, Nate Powell, and his material as a comics maker and illustrator.
I want to get to that, but I want to talk to you a little bit more about your artwork. So first of all, where did you, when did you begin producing your own comics, and who were your inspirations?
Well, Nate Powell is probably my favorite cartoonist. And I started probably in my early 30s. I didn't think making comics was even in my wheelhouse until I went to a self-publishing and zine festival. And I was like, oh, wow, this is something that I can do. I can share all of my mental health knowledge as a counselor in a very different way outside of my practice or with individuals. I can put it in the hands of people, like a tangible thing. So yeah, that's how I started, not until my early 30s. Yeah.
And so you're a professional in the mental health world.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What role do you occupy?
Oh, I'm a clinical mental health counselor.
Okay. Yeah. And so the stories that you share and that you write about, are they also rooted in personal experience, or are they more of just kind of based on the work that you do?
Some of them have been. That's how it kind of started out, was being able to process through my own trauma, my own emotional state, as well as Nate Powell. He talks a lot about doing that with his comics as well. Using all the senses to be able to garner empathy from people through comics. So, yeah.
So we've mentioned Nate a couple of times. He's a really well-known creator and illustrator and comic. He is going to be at your event. I best know him for the March series, that three-part book that was written with
John Lewis.
Yeah, yes, Congressman John Lewis, right, mm-hmm. which is just an incredible account of the civil rights movement. But he's done a lot of other stuff.
Yes. So the newest thing that's coming out is called Lies My Teacher Told Me, which is based on a book already, but he is the illustrator for that. He has another graphic novel that's coming out called Fall Through. It's about the punk scene, but also traveling through time and reliving those memories. And what else do we have? I have the list in front of me.
That's okay. I want to ask Lindsay and bring her in a little bit here to talk about the work that you do. So your stuff is also known to be edgy.
Yes.
You had a series called River City Raunch, which chronicled people's love lives anonymously. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. I found myself having a lot of conversations with strangers and about our experiences with love, sex, and dating in Jacksonville. And I felt that not a lot of people spoke openly or intelligently about them. It was mostly, you know, people joking about it or bragging about their experiences. So having these very real conversations with people just kind of stuck with me. And I felt like we needed to know more about each other in these ways. But how was I going to do that without, you know, giving out secrets or telling very personal things about people that maybe they didn't want everybody to know, but the information was there. So they would give me permission to print these stories that we would just talk about in person, face to face, just as long as it was anonymous. And
how were they received?
They were received. Well, it took about, I made about 7 issues before anybody really caught on. Then after the 7th issue, Shelton Hull had written an article in the Folio about it. And then it was well received all over the board. Everybody wanted to be heard is really what it felt like to me, is people wanted to be seen, wanted to be heard, wanted to be understood and talk about their experiences with other people. And getting people to get the zine in their hand, read it, and then how they interpreted that information was very interesting to me as well.
So let's talk about the festival that's coming up at the main library. It's going to have a lot of opportunity for people to try out new things that they maybe haven't thought about trying before.
So we're going to start off with Saturday morning cartooning. Then there's going to be a writer's lab with Tony Ayupi. And that is all about formatting zines for print or printing yourself. Of course, we have the Lit Chat with Nate Powell. We're very excited to have him with us from 4 to 5. We have the library is providing teen programming. So teens can learn how to make a zine from 1 to 2, 3 to 4.
We should say this is all happening on Saturday, June 15th.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. That would be the
date. And it's at the main library?
Main library downtown off Laura Street. And that is going to be from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m.
And just briefly, Lindsay, for people who haven't tried their hand at anything like this, why would you encourage them to come?
Just the same reason that Dawn was saying, because when you go to an event like this, it's inspiring to see all the different formats, all the different ages, backgrounds, subjects. It's possible for you to create, to make something tangible out of your passions.
Well, it's excellent to hear about all the DIY stuff that's on your plate. And thank you so much, Lindsay Anderson and Dan Whaley, for coming in to talk about it.
Thank you so much.
I hope the festival's fun.
We'll see you there.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be right back with your opportunity to try out Broadway on the First Coast.
When the former president got convicted of 34 felonies, the first thing he said, of course, was...
I'm a very innocent man.
But the second thing he said was weirdly...
Millions and millions of people pouring into our country right now from prisons and from mental institutions, terrorists.
We're taking a good look at our immigration nation next time on Today Explained.
Tonight at 6:30 here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Deepa Fernandez. Nearly one in three Americans are employed and above the poverty line, but still struggle to make ends meet.
If my parents were able to somehow make it work, why can't I make it work on my own? Why are my parents always stepping in to help me?
Why life for so many doesn't square with the news of a strong economy. Next time, Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, MSNBC host Ali Velshi talks about his ancestors' migrations from a village in India through South Africa, Kenya, and Canada. One of the figures in the story is Mahatma Gandhi, who knew Velshi's grandfather and had a powerful influence on the family. Velshi's new book is called Small Acts of Courage. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The world's largest election is now complete, and nearly a billion Indians have spoken. Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Hindu nationalist party, BJP, are setting up for 5 more years in power. What do the results mean for India and the world? Join me, Jen White, to share what you know, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. We may not be able to make it to Broadway this summer, but fortunately the stage and much of its talent is coming to the First Coast. And to talk about it, I'm joined by Shelley Henley with the FSCJ Artist Series. Hey, Shelley, welcome on.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So the Artist Series is hosting a summer camp this year, and the classes are actually being taught by Broadway professionals.
Yes, that's right. We've been doing this for a number of years now. It's called Next Stop Broadway. And it's a week-long musical theater program taught by actors and performers from Broadway. They come in, and we have the director who has been in Broadway his whole life since he was a child. Started off, when he was 10 years old.
That's Tony Parise.
That's correct. Tony Parise. He's the director, and it focuses on being on the ensemble of a classic Broadway show.
I was interested to see. I mean, he's been in Broadway all of his life, as you say, since he was a child, but he also directed the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, which I thought was really cool. That's kind of an unusual directorial effort.
Yes. And then you can imagine how putting all that together for one show, so many different aspects of Broadway. So that's kind of what he does here.
A lot of moving parts. And then you also have, is it Karen Strating, who is a dance captain for Baryshnikov on Broadway?
Yes. And she's a choreographer, and she comes in along with several other professionals to teach the classes.
So is this an audition type summer camp where kids have to be involved in the arts?
No. It requires no experience. Everyone is taken in, and they determine, they put them in groups and determine, which group would fit them best. And they just come in every day as if they were coming to work on a Broadway show. They come in and they sign in and they check the board to see what, assignments they have, what the calling is for that day, and we'll go to the various classes and workshops and rehearsals and start working on the shows.
So they don't have to come in necessarily with the skill set of being, knowing choreography, knowing musical theater.
No previous experience is required. They will teach them, everything they need to know to be able to perform by the end of the week.
And so the idea is somewhat to mimic kind of the frenetic atmosphere of a Broadway production, to put them on this deadline, to put them on a schedule where they have to, quickly get up to speed, quickly turn it around into a show. And so that's part of the dynamic that you create.
Exactly. Yeah. Just like as if they were on Broadway, and they will come in and, like I say, go into little groups. They'll get to work on their creativity and also put together some little mini musicals that they'll work on throughout the week. So some will get to write, perhaps, or some will choreograph, and they'll learn blocking and all the various different aspects.
So what ages is this for?
10 to 17. Children 10 to 17 can come in, and they will all be welcomed.
Do they turn this performance for anybody? Like at the end of the week, do they get to put it on for
they
guests?
They prepare, and by the end of the week, they will do a opening night performance for friends and family. This all takes place at the Wilson Center out at the FSCJ South Campus on Beach Boulevard, and we have a beautiful theater out there, the Wilson. and that's where they will put on their show.
So part of the works that they're going to be looking at this year are the works of Lerner and Lowe. They're kind of famous partners in crime on Broadway, lyricist and librettist. What particular performances that they're known for are you going to be focusing on?
Yes. Well, this year they'll be doing some scenes from Brigadoon and My Fair Lady. It's always some type of classic Broadway show. And this year will be Brigadoon and My Fair Lady.
Are there kids who are going to be kind of like the leads of this production? Are they going to be cast once they're, you know, into the production? Are they going to become assigned a leading role?
Right. They will, you know, audition for the various parts, and they will all have different roles. Some will dance and sing, and others will have more major roles. But everybody will participate and be in the show in one way or another.
Yeah. And so this is a not inexpensive summer camp. So talk to us about the possibilities that people can get some financial aid.
Well, the Artist Series is a nonprofit, and due to the fact that we, you know, that's what we are here for, to bring entertainment to Jacksonville, we offer a half price scholarship. So this is worth $300 towards the show. So it'll cut the price in half and make it affordable for many more people. And all they have to do is write a paragraph about what's inspired them to their interest in theater.
Oh.
And it's very simple. It doesn't require a lot of hoops to jump through. And this actually starts next week. So we do still have some spots open. So you still can get in. You can go to our website and find the application and all the instructions on what they need to do to apply for the scholarship.
And FSCJ Artist Series, for people who don't know, I mean, it's run out of the Florida...
Yeah, the Florida State College of Jacksonville.
I know it's an acronym. But this is a part of a broader artist series that you do every year.
Yes. We're part of the foundation, and they are what put the shows on. And it's a nonprofit. We bring Broadway in Jacksonville. We've got 5 big Broadway shows scheduled for the next 24-25 season that are on sale now, subscriptions. And we've got all kinds of, you know, some classics and some new shows. So it should be very exciting. And then all types of shows. We offer Broadway, ballet, just all types of arts to expose Jacksonville and give them that opportunity.
All right. Well, Shelley Henley, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And that's our program. Join us tomorrow when incoming City Council President Randy White talks about stadium expenditures, policy priorities, and takes your questions on air. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.